From Brighton and Hove Museums, this is Tell Me About the Chamber Pots, a five-part podcast series about a year of innovative experiments in digital storytelling across our museum spaces.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Petz, and I've worked alongside Brighton and Hove Museums on various different projects over the past few years, including producing podcasts and looking at new ways to tell stories. Over the past 18 months, led by former head of digital Kevin Bacon, Brighton and Hove Museums has run several live experiments in different kinds of community and digital storytelling. We've worked with tech companies, academics, and most importantly, volunteers from across our Brighton and Hove communities. We've unpacked the different ways people interact with exhibits, and we've experimented with new cutting-edge tools and methods for telling stories to better help bring the museum to life.
Episode 5, a focus on inclusivity.
To conclude our series, we have a conversation with Liz Porter and Simone Le Corbinier, Brighton and Hove Museum's joint heads of diversity and inclusion, and Carol Evans, Director of Engagement and Public Programmes. When they spoke, they had just been around Preston Manor and experienced the new volunteer-led audio guide stories for themselves. The conversation begins with their reflections on that experience.
Liz Porter, Joint Head of Diversity and Inclusion.
Simone Le Corbinier, Joint Head of Diversity and Inclusion.
Carol Evans, Director of Engagement and Public Programmes.
Liz Porter here. What I really liked was the enthusiastic conversational voices that were used within the different rooms. It really felt like people were really interested and passionate about the choices they had made to talk about the people they were talking about or the objects in the room. And I really liked that. It felt like I was being invited into their spaces. And that was that, you know, kind of was a very engaging, you know, start to my experience. It slightly felt like it was coming from a slightly different, more human-led perspective.
I totally agree with what you're saying. I also liked, I think the volunteers asked different questions to the sorts of questions that traditional experts might ask when they were interrogating the material or when they were thinking of what to include in the history. And obviously, from a diversity point of view, the more varied voices you get, the better. But also from an entertainment perspective, how nice to hear so many different voices as you went through Preston Manor.
People came to it with their own perspectives and how they wanted to do it. So there's such difference between some of the different rooms, some more factual, some more creative, some more sort of inspired by. And that's something from a professional point of view in terms of interpretation, just in that relatively small group of people, the different ways they wanted to approach it, we should probably be thinking that at least when we do interpretation, that we should be thinking about a more creative approach, a more factual approach, and a whole range of different things. The very sort of nub of what turned into the project was a conversation that Kevin Bacon and I had about interpretation, and that in any group I've ever taken round or talked to them about or introduced to a project, if there's a bright six-year-old in the group, that they will... doesn't matter whether it's an indoor or outdoor thing, somebody will always ask, and it's always a child because they haven't had the filters put in place yet, where did they go to the toilet? And actually, that's what everyone really wants to know. But it's almost become, at a certain point, it's impolite to ask that question. But that's like the first thing when you are a visitor, you think, when you get there, where can I go to the loo? The comfort break. You know, it's how you keep an army marching without killing them with dysentery and all those sort of basic things. And actually, are we telling people anything about what they really, really want to know about a site, about a project, about a landscape, about anything? So trying to get that sort of natural curiosity in answering those questions and that breadth of inquiry and interest that people have. It's a sort of really interesting snapshot into people's perspectives on it, that if we rolled it out across all our sites, that would probably completely change how we actually talk to people about them. With the growth of technology, there are ways to do that. We could even have, you know, you can have a live chat when you try and get hold of your electricity company. Why can't you have a live chat on every Thursday afternoon with an expert in how we do the plumbing in the museums rather than You know, the curator of fine art, for instance. So, I mean, why aren't we asking and answering the questions about how we build things, how we do things behind the scenes? Because people love that.
They do. And I would like to add to that, I'm visually impaired, and one of the things I was really enjoying listening to people's voices, but for me, when I walk in a room, I need to know what's in the room. And so my question is, what's in the room? And some of the people had chosen to find ways to kind of put mini descriptions into their little stories and the people they were talking about. And sort of because they were talking about the day in the life of this person, they kind of signposted me to kind of think about the things that were in the room because they were being brought into the story. And I did actually miss that element in some of the other stories when we went into other rooms because I wanted to know what I might be looking at. And so for me, that sort of raises to me that how important it is at the beginning of any kind of project is to really encourage people to think about all audiences, even though they're using their own voices and the things that interest them, how do we actually bring that conversation into it? Some of the rooms were upstairs, and I'm talking as a visually impaired person, but of course there are other people who have different impairments who might need different ways to listen to things. And one of the volunteers said, well, actually, you know, if you can't get up the stairs, how do you show what's in that room? And they came up with a suggestion of a 360 mirror, not mirror, camera, sort of taking the pictures of the space as you walked around. And I think it's really important that we do think about how we're going to share the stories to different audiences, but make it easy for them to engage and not lose that essence of being interested in what she's done in her day and just bringing it alive in different formats.
I think that raises a really interesting question, Liz, about how much we are able to diversify the people that contribute, because although we had different voices, we by no means had all voices covered, did we? And it's kind of impossible to do things, I mean, we can to a certain extent, but to do things for other groups that we don't fully understand because we don't walk in their shoes. It's much better if we can get them to do it as much as possible.
Exactly, and it actually would be really interesting if we were, and I'd quite like the idea of exploring how we might roll this out in different parts of the different sites, because they've all got different energies. For example, the feel and experience that you have when you're in the Preston Manor is very different to the feel and experience that you have when you're walking through the Royal Pavilion. But, you know, Carol, you talked about children and children asking questions, you know, quite very direct questions sometimes. Well, what would it be like if we were doing this project with a group of 10-year-olds? I wonder which object they would have chosen or which rooms they would have sort of honed in on as places they want to sort of tell stories about.
And the way children look at the world is just so different and so engaging. We should be encouraging that natural curiosity that everyone is ultimately born with. And why not channel that? So maybe the next thing we want to do is guides created by, with children, for children, yeah. For adults, what children think adults should be telling them when they go and visit places, which could be a whole other concept about how you do family-friendly programming, for instance, or school programming. And we consult, and at the Booth Museum at the moment, we're actually running a different project that's not about spoken words and interpretation, but we're just asking people to send us postcards and what would you like to know about things? And we're getting the most wonderful questions. Some of them are so far away from what we'd ever have expected. They're slightly mind-blowing, but in such a good way. And then we're getting quite a few repeat questions. And that's telling us that we're not telling people what they want to know. So we're going to start changing. And we can be much more relaxed about it. We should never be snobbish about knowledge, about history, about things. Everyone's lived. Everyone's got a history. We shouldn't just be doing it about the posh people who earned the money. When you think about, you know, all sorts of visitor stats and feedback and studies that are done, it's often the kitchens, it's the back rooms. What did the maids do? And all that sort of practicalities rather than the rich people who made it, who created it, who used it, who cleaned it. And I mean, that's always the subject that always gets forgotten. You have the artist might be named, but the person who cleaned it for the next 30 years, you never hear about them. So those are the stories I'm always wanting to know about, probably because, you know, my grandmother was a housemaid and she'd wander around posh houses and go, oh, that's a bugger to dust. And that has stuck with me from, you know, from day one.
You know, Simone, you were talking about diverse voices. I mean, I was just sort of thinking here, actually, it's not just about sort of diverse voices, about what people choose to talk about and whether there would be any difference. It was a more diverse group of people telling the stories, whether they would actually choose to hone in on the stories that they felt more connection with within the room.
Yeah, and isn't this what decolonisation is? It's if colonisation is one group of people controlling the resources, controlling the land, controlling the stories, controlling other people's bodies, if that's what colonisation is and was, isn't decolonisation broader than just what we did abroad, for example?
Yeah.
And, you know, going back to children, I think that's hearing more children's voices, not just for speaking to each other or for speaking to families, but just hearing their voices anyway, that is, you know, that's a decolonising thing to do in and of itself.
We could have audiences from different, you know, whose language is not, English is not necessarily their first language, coming forward and taking a response from what in their language and speaking, you know, that would actually give a very different dimension, but would open up the scope of who can listen and engage with our audio interpretation. And that, for me, would be really interesting and exciting. I don't know, because the thing is, then you sort of think, well, not all language is a spoken language. For example, British Sign Language is a language in its own right. So what would happen if we actually opened up this opportunity to a group of deaf BSL speakers? Obviously, that would need to be captured in a different way other than an audio output as a visual output. But I think it's the concept of allowing people to explore and to find interest in the research that they're doing to tell the stories in the way that they want, but also that's really exciting here. But then I think even then, it is probably important to encourage people to try and think about who their audiences are, and of course that would be everybody, so that we could get a little bit of guidance perhaps to make sure that perhaps key and important facts are woven into the bits of stories that they've told, so that everybody gets at least the basic information that they need for each room that they're in.
Realistic, there's nothing stopping us doing it apart from a bit of imagination, a bit of planning time, and deciding what as a priority that as an organisation we want to do. And obviously part of that decision making process should be listening to our audiences. So this is going to be a great test bed if we get a response to it, if people respond to it, if people love it, people hate it, people shrug and go or anything in between, and then that'll help us shape about how worthwhile it is to look at it in the future. And certainly, I think we need to give it a good long test, and we need to publicise it properly to our visitors. And that's always the key thing, that they find out about it after the event, or, oh, I wish we'd known about it half an hour ago. And so, it's a matter of information in many ways. But there's nothing stopping us at all.
Can I just chip in on funding? Mm. Being able to volunteer is quite a privilege.
Absolutely.
So if we're not paying people, we are excluding quite a lot of people from even being able to contribute. So I think it's really important to look at how we can bring in people who literally can't afford to give their time for free.
Maybe there's a bit of research that needs to be done about the barriers that people experience. Are there perceptions? I'm not making any assumptions here, I'm just questioning. Are there barriers because people think what they're going to experience when they walk through a door is still speaking of colony and empire, is still speaking of content that doesn't speak to the culture or them as individuals and their identities? I don't know. I'm just posing questions to wonder how do we get around those barriers? Is it because the information wasn't sent to a broad enough network of people, or outside the usual places that we put calls to volunteers to? Was it the time of day the project was happening? All those kind of things. I mean, it would be
There is a lot of evidence, not in terms of volunteering, but in terms of being involved and accessing cultural projects and cultural spaces, that black and brown people, the barriers, so if you're British person of colour, the barriers aren't so much cultural as fear of discrimination, or, as you say, you know, are they going to be walking into a really colonial space with colonial practices? And sometimes with these audiences, it is about the framing and saying, we want to decolonize. And then you'll get a certain type of person who is really keen to be part of that. But asking people who maybe haven't had good experiences of museums or cultural spaces in the past, who maybe, you know, if you've grown up in the 90s and you've faced discrimination, or you've observed lack of diversity when you have gone into a museum, all these things, you know, it doesn't say to you that you're going to have a positive experience were you to get involved. Mm. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do in the language that we use.
Yeah.
What I really love is how creatively we're now thinking, and about how many different voices, because I just, as we were having the chat, I was just thinking, wouldn't it be great to have some people from the countries of origins where they have the ornaments in the cases?
That's a really good idea.
And that's a way to bring maybe other languages, so we still play it in their voice, but then we have a translation or subtitles or an audio overlay, you know what I mean. It's just amazing that this project has led, I think, to thinking about how many different voices aren't heard, not just in this country, but around the world, even for somewhere quite small in terms of, you know, the Royal Estate and Brighton and Hove Museums, as Preston Manor.
This is like 100 projects that we could come up with here. And that's probably also with that, you'd have to think about who is leading those projects. And I just suddenly think I ought to bring that into that. I think it could be interesting to look at having a group of diverse people leading the project. That may change it, I don't know. You know, that would be interesting to research as well, so that you could actually look at if people respond differently to different people facilitating sessions.
So we leave go of anything apart from the mechanism of putting it out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we literally put it on
the machine.
You're
basically talking about decolonising ourselves.
Well, I'm not.
Liz.
I'm not actually necessarily. What I mean is, I think that actually, just because I know my experience of working with, just because it came to my head, deaf people who are BSL speakers, if you were going to do a BSL speaking project, you might have a facilitator that's sort of a coordinator across the whole project, because you absolutely probably would need that. But that should be facilitated by a deaf historian, because actually it's just like sometimes you need to work with people who have similar lived experiences, not always. And that also raises the really important question about representation and who leads on projects in museums as well.
I think it's a really, really good point. Control is a colonial practice, isn't it? It's we control the narrative, and we're talking about letting go of it a bit, but is that still quite a colonial practice? Because we're saying, okay, you can do that bit, but overall we're still going to tell you how this goes, where the story goes, what we're saying, and how we're presenting our spaces and how we're presenting our stories and our objects.
I suppose it depends if you're looking at having a factual response or a creative response. I think there's two approaches. If you're having a factual response, I suppose you have to have someone fact-checking.
But people can be experts but not part of Brighton and Hove Museums.
Yeah, of course they can. But, I mean, you still have to. If you're talking about Preston Manor and you were talking about Preston Manor's history, inverted commas, you'd probably still have to have someone having an eye on, looking, you know, keeping an eye on fact-checking information, because if, unless you were doing a completely creative response, that, I mean, there's a different thing, isn't it?
The point I'm making is who's doing the fact-checking.
Depends what you're defining as fact, really.
Yeah, that's the answer. Depends.
So,
Exactly.
So, I mean, there's certain things you could almost, everyone could probably agree on that, you know, the house was built on X date. if we talk about the Stanfords as landowners, and oh, they were very kind to the as was town of Brighton, and they gave lots of land, and weren't they marvellous? How did they own that land in the first place? Did giving it away actually mean they ended up sacking people who worked as groundskeepers? You know, all that sort of thing. I mean, that's just the basic kind of concept. So, yeah, it's what a fact is. And, you know, the whole concept with history of to prove something actually really happened, you need three versions of it, preferably from people who all have don't actually come from the same side. And then whatever the Venn diagram in the middle probably did actually happen. But, you know, history is written by the victors, as they say, or history is written by the people in control. Yeah. And there's been huge amounts of work in museums and by historians over the last decades to try and present the forgotten voices or the hidden voices and things like that. And I don't particularly like using those terms because they become a little bit self-perpetuating themselves. But it should just be history. It shouldn't just be talked about women's history. It's just history. And in the same concept, it shouldn't just, you know, everything is history in effect. So, yeah, people's responses and people looking at things from a different perspective and researching that difference of historical opinion. And very often, how do you find those other records, whatever they might be? You know, we haven't got the housemaid's diary in the same way we've got the lady of the house's diary. Because, well, frankly, the housemaid was probably too exhausted
or couldn't write
at a certain point. So you've got all of those sort of things. And that's where maybe the creative response comes through, is what do you think the alternative viewpoint was? Yeah. And the fact that the records just forget so many people, that maybe it's that combination of what is a fact? Do we want to do the facts? Do we want to have the creative response? And different things will work differently for different people. And that brings us back around to the very, very audience and current audience, future audience.
And history is so massive, isn't it? So when you start telling the history, where do you begin and end? And who's made the decision about where you begin and end? Yeah.
If we knew the answer to that, wouldn't we?
Thank you very much for listening. Contributors to this episode include Kevin Bacon, Liz Porter, Simone Le Corbinier, and Carol Evans. We're so grateful to all of them for donating their time to this important part of the conversation. This has been such a great project to be part of. We were so lucky with the level of enthusiasm from the volunteers we had and all the staff who took part as well. And I hope they genuinely feel really proud of what they created.
Tell Me About the Chamber Pots is a Brighton and Hove Museums production. It was written, presented and edited by Charlotte Petts and me, Chris Thorpe Tracy. The main interviewer was Kevin Bacon. This series is produced by Nick Kay and Kevin Bacon for Brighton and Hove Museums. Find us online at brightonmuseums.org.uk. That's brightonmuseums.org.uk.